Good afternoon. Last time we talked about an alternative to our monitors, which we said we were solving the problem that locks weren't flexible enough for us. So we wanted some way of having a more general synchronization construct that we could use to solve a lot of different problems. So our second solution was this thing called semaphores. And semaphores were a counter, but we never actually read the value of the counter. Instead, we used these two operations to manipulate the counter. There was an up operation that incremented it, and a down operation that decremented it. But if the counter would go below zero, instead it waited for it to be positive first. And the intuition we have with this is that you keep track of how much of a resource you have with these counters, and you just do the appropriate bookkeeping to make sure that count stays accurate. And just by doing that, you're going to wait when you're not missing some of that resource and you want more because of how the down operation waits while the count would have become negative. Mentioned that though we introduced counting semaphores, there's a simpler to implement version of called binary semaphores, where rather than allowing a count that's zero up to some large number, we just say zero or one, that's the only numbers you can have. And it turns out that that's just as good as counting semaphores in the sense that if you have a bunch of binary semaphores and some storage, you can implement counting semaphores, so they must be able to do everything that counting semaphores can do. We also mentioned, semaphores and monitors, they look very different, and it's not obvious that they solve the same problems, but we can show that they really have the same capabilities, because we can use semaphores to implement monitors. And this wasn't so obvious, because it looked like we had a big problem with a disconnect between how semaphores worked and monitors worked. With semaphores, when we did this up operation, it seemed like we were affecting what happened in the future. So even if something wasn't waiting, we'd stop something in the future from waiting, whereas with condition variables and monitors, we had this signal or broadcast operation which only cared about things which were waiting now. And we have this trick to avoid that, which we'll see again later today, of tracking, how many people are waiting, and based on that, we made our decision of how much to increment our semaphore. And the key idea is that we could track whether there were waiters, and therefore we could undo the property that we wake up someone in the future by knowing, if there's no one to wake up, don't increment the semaphore. We saw that also monitors could be used to implement semaphores. Then we talked about a synchronization construct that's more focused. So when we started, we introduced barriers, which we mentioned have this very particular problem that's just very common. So we wanted something specialized for them. Talked about another type of synchronization. We were in something specialized, which is reader-writer locks. So here we have some data structure that multiple threads can read at the same time without problems. But if any thread's writing it, we better not have anyone else trying to look at it, or else they'll get confused. Like maybe we have a hash table, and we don't want to risk anyone trying to access it while someone might be resizing it and rehashing everything. Or we'll get confused. And reader-writer locks can provide this sort of property. And we saw that, reader-writer locks are a primitive you could rely on your threading library having, but there's also something that we can use to illustrate how we can implement sort of our own choice of how to synchronize things with monitors. And I showed you an implementation with monitors, and I believe when we left off, we realized that that implementation had this sort of oddity in the case when a writer was finishing up, that we needed to decide, there's no more, the writer's finished, and if we have a reader and a writer ready to go, what do we do? And the decision in our implementation was we woke both of them up, and one of them would run first. Which one? Depends how the condition variables work. And whichever one woke up first would increment the number of readers or writers. The one that woke up second would look at the numbers of readers or writers and say, I was woken up, but I can't do anything. and start waiting again. And we might be pretty dissatisfied with that. So we'll talk about how to fix that by choosing a priority between the two later. But before I move on, questions about semaphores or relating monitors and semaphores and so on. So let's look at our priority problem. So I said with our reader-writer lock, originally we were in this situation where we just woke up the readers and woke up the writers when there were no readers or writers and just let whatever happens happen. But we might instead want a policy which avoids the problem of waking people up who aren't going to be able to go, and also take this chance to make a decision about what's important to us. Do we want writers to go first or readers to go first? And we can implement both policies. And when we write down what does it mean for writers to go first, we get a statement like, well, if writers go first, then no reader should go when a writer is waiting. And this statement is going to tell us how we're going to add that to our implementation of reader-writer locks. That this means that to make writers go first, we need to figure out if there's a writer waiting. So we need some sort of variable that tracks that. And we need to check that before we allow a reader to proceed. And that's precisely what we're going to do to make that decision. And similarly, in the reader's first case, the extra condition you write down is that no writers go when a reader is waiting. So we're going to use this. And the first observation we have about this is that, well, we need to track the number of waiting readers or writers, depending on which of these policies we're implementing, in order to make that decision. How are we going to do that? Well, we can just have a count. And like you saw when we were implementing condition variables with semaphores, we'll just increment the count when someone starts waiting, decrement it when they stop. So with that in mind, here's my writer priority implementation, where I've just added a few things that weren't there, taking into account this waiting writers. So one thing I added was just the counter of waiting writers. So I said, okay, we have a number of waiting writers, initially zero. And before I start waiting in write lock, I increment the number. After I'm done waiting, I decrement it. That's keeping track of that count. And then we have the rule that I wrote down was no readers can go when there's a waiting writer. So while there are writers or there are waiting writers, readers have to wait. Previously, it's just while there were writers. Now they also have to wait if any writers are waiting, even if they can't go yet. And we have a second part to this, which is that we need to make sure that the cases where we signal our readers matches up with this, or else we'll be waking up readers when they can't go. So I need to make sure that if there are waiting writers, I don't broadcast to my readers. So I'm making sure that this broadcast of the readers not matches up with my new condition. Questions? Right here. So by implementing this policy, I have now decided that writers get priority over readers. We might want to do this because, well, if we have a lot of readers, writers might be starved otherwise, and this prevents that. And to implement that, I needed to not only track the number of waiting writers and update when readers wait, you know, to make sure I didn't needlessly wake up readers, I also updated the code around broadcasting to wake up readers to be consistent with what readers were now waiting for. And if we look at how this works, let's look at a scenario where we have four threads And the first two threads are going to be running readers. So they're going to get a read lock, do some reading, read unlock. The third thread is going to be running a writer. So it's going to get a write lock, do some reading and writing together, then unlock. And the fourth thread is going to be another reader. And remember, we're tracking some state here. So we have a number of writers, a number of readers, and a number of waiting writers. And that initially, that's all zero. So then our first reader comes along, and it runs read lock. And while it has the mutex, it's going to check the number of readers and writers, writers and waiting writers, and find out they're both zero, so it doesn't have to wait, and increment the number of readers, and then it's going to be done. And similarly, our second reader will come along, grab the mutex, read that there's no writers or waiting writers, and move along. So where things get tricky is when our writer comes along. So our writer comes along and calls write lock. It grabs the mutex, increments the number of waiting writers, then checks the number of writers and readers, and finds out that there is at least one of those. And so it starts waiting and releases the mutex. And while this is happening, our readers are still reading. They don't have the mutex when they're doing that because the mutex is just internal to the lock. And then our read lock comes along, and it's going to wait. It's going to look at its condition and say, oh, there are waiting writers, so I have to wait. So it looks at this waiting writers value, says, oh, I have to wait. So it's going to grab it, the lock, to check the numbers, find out, oh, there's waiting writers, and start waiting. So then our first reader is eventually going to finish up. It's going to decrement the number of readers down to 1. And our next one decrements it down to 0. And when that happens, we're going to say, oh, there's no readers. This means now the writer's condition could be true. So I'm going to signal a writer to go. So at this point, the write lock will stop waiting. It's going to double check its condition, find out, yes, in fact, there are still no readers and no writers. So it will change itself from a waiting writer to a writer. It will do whatever it wanted to do, reading and writing. And when it finishes, it's going to look at the number of waiting writers, and that's now 0. And so based on that, it's going to realize, okay, that means that now readers might stop waiting. There's no waiting writers or readers. Readers aren't relevant, but there's no waiting writers or writers. So let's broadcast to the readers and say, hey, you can go now. Then the reader will go and increment the number of readers, and so on. So questions about anything which happened here? Question, is the read lock different than a regular lock because multiple threads can have it? Yes. And that is, okay, so the read part of the lock is shared. The write version of the lock is not shared with anyone, including read lockers. Okay, other questions? Okay, so I showed you the writer priority version here. And this is writer priority because when our writer was waiting, readers weren't allowed to go. Basically, we said, once a writer starts waiting, we're going to just let everyone finish and then take over. Like, the only way we could have more priority for writers if we had a way of stopping someone while they're reading, but that's usually not remotely practical. So we're not going to do that. We're just going to wait until they finish up what they're doing. But we're not going to let anyone else start until the writing happens. We could also implement the reader priority. And remember, for reader priority, we wanted to say writers don't go if readers are waiting. So to add that, we're going to track the number of waiting readers. And we're doing the same thing we did before, with readers. And we're going to check while there's no readers, writers, or waiting readers, we wait. Or while there's any readers, writers, or waiting readers, write waits. So until there's none of those, writes aren't allowed to happen. And when deciding whether to signal writers or readers, we only signal writers if there are no readers or waiting readers. So if we did some writing and a reader came along in the meanwhile, and there's another writer waiting, too bad, readers get to go next. This is the other option for who goes next. Questions? Differences here? Okay. So I showed you two policies, writers first and readers first, and those aren't the only options. So let's say we want to do something in the middle. Say I want to have reader priority, but the problem with reader priority is that if we have enough readers, writers will never get a chance to go. There'll always be a waiting reader, like almost all the time. So we might want a policy that is prevents starvation, like we saw with, you know, the multi-level feedback queues. We'll like do something to make sure writers don't get starved. And my solution I'm proposing here is that we should have reader priority except if writers are waiting more than 1 second. If writers have been waiting more than 1 second, readers stop having priority and writers have priority instead. So how could we, what could we add to this to make that happen? Where should we make changes? Discuss with your neighbor, see if you think, agree. Someone have something I can add? So what's something I need to add to this to implement this policy? What's a place that needs to be changed? Let's start with that, if nothing else. Yeah.
The if statements for waiting readers equal zero.
Okay, so you're saying these if statements, they need to change because right now they're saying we only wake up a writer if there are no waiting readers, but we want to have an exception to that. So this is if waiting readers is zero, or writers waiting too long. So any other places where we need to make some changes? So one thing to think about is what's going to happen when I signal in this new case. Yeah, back there. Yeah, so your problem, you're observing waiting readers might not be zero here, and this writer will wake up, double check its condition, and say, oh, I still need to wait. And so our problem is that we weren't consistent for between how we signal the condition variable and what we check for when we're waiting on it. So we need to fix that. So we can adjust this to or no readers, writers, and writers waiting too long. So, and that's a general rule you can use to check your logic, is that if you look at this, you know, this condition wait condition needs to be consistent with the why do we signal condition. That if you're signaling and it's still going to wait, that's probably not great. Okay. Anything else we should change? So there's one place where we have a condition that might need changing, which is in read lock. Is that okay? Is there something that might help there to fix? Or is it like fine the way it is? And something to remember here is that we have to worry about this condition both for waking up and for deciding whether to wait at all. So you're saying you want to make sure there aren't any waiting writers. So we don't check that right now because reader priority says we don't care about waiting writers, but we care with an exception. So we want to check for the exception. So while there are writers or there are writers waiting too long. Writers waiting too long. So not actual writers, but waiting writers who've been waiting too long. Yeah, hope would-be writers be writers waiting too long. So that's the other thing we need to check. And a way we could have like reasoned about that is that we might observe that now we have an inconsistency here between when we broadcast on OK to read, which should be suspicious to us. Like, do we actually need to check those conditions, that extra condition, you know, accommodate for the extra condition? And you might say, what about waiting readers? We didn't check waiting readers, but trivially, waiting readers is not zero. So in that loop, because we just incremented it before checking the condition. So questions about the solution I have here. Yeah.
What did you add to the write lock?
What did I add to the write lock?
Yeah, at the top.
This is or there's no readers or writers and writers are waiting too long. So basically, this is just the same condition we had before, but replacing waiting readers, no waiting readers with there are waiting writers who are waiting too long. Other questions? OK. So our next topic is going to be about a problem that's most well known for occurring with thread synchronization called deadlock. I'm going to start out with some examples which aren't really about threaded programs. I'll start out with two cars on a one-lane bridge. So, you know, let's say our strategy for driving these cars is we look at the road ahead of us, and if there's space there, we're just going to keep going. And if there's not, we're going to wait. You know, some of that is going to clear up. So we do this. We say, oh, there's space. Great. We'll just drive ahead and look ahead. Well, there's not space. Just going to wait. You know, eventually they'll move. And if both of our policy, both the policies of these drivers is, well, eventually they'll move, we know no one's going to make progress. And this is an example of a problem called deadlock. I'm giving this example because this will help us reason about like what our fixes for it are in our when it's less of a physical problem and more of a programming problem. And with this problem, it's very obvious because we have like exactly two things and they're both waiting on each other, but it doesn't have to be so direct. So a classic sort of thought problem for deadlock is the dining philosopher's problem. So in this scenario, we have five philosophers at a table, and someone who is really bad at setting the table has decided that we're going to eat this meal with chopsticks, and well, if you have a chopstick on your left and your right, that's enough. And we tested this. Every table, every seat at this table, I could sit at and eat. So it must work. So we're just going to, you know, test it every seat. Worked fine. So this is how I set the table, have all the philosophers there. And let's say the philosophers, you know, they just grab the chopstick on their left. And then they wait for the chopstick on their right. And they're, you know, maybe they're stubborn about it. You know, they'll eventually, that arrogant person on the side will put it down. So they'll just wait for the chopstick on their right. And they'll just keep waiting. And observe here, unlike our first situation, that we can't actually point to two people and say they're both waiting for each other. Like, it's less direct. And this is what's kind of annoying about this deadlock problem, is that often it's not obvious why it's happening, because like there's a chain of causality between things which aren't directly related. And another thing is that like it's very timing dependent, that if they had eaten and taken turns eating, there would be no problem. They had eaten at a slightly different, if they have grabbed their chopsticks at a slightly different time, there would be no problem because one of them would get both of their chopsticks and they would get to finish eating. And when they finished eating, someone else would get to go. We wouldn't be waiting forever. So we're going to talk about like less abstract versions of this. So let's look at a less abstract version. See a problem we've already seen. So here I have a very simple example of a parent and child process communicating with each other. And the idea is we're going to read and write. So our child and parent, here I'm just showing sending a buffer, but presumably in a more full example, we'd like compute something for the buffer and then do something afterwards. I've just omitted that code for space. So we do this logical thing. I want to make a new process, send stuff to it, receive stuff back, while it set and have it send stuff to me and I receive stuff, send stuff back, read stuff back. So, you know, two-way communication with another process. So we know we can communicate with another process with a pipe, and we want to do it in both directions, so I made two pipes. Makes sense? And the child writes to the parent, then reads from the parent writes to the child, then reads from the child. And this seems like a reasonable plan, but this is gonna hang forever. So what's the problem? You know, why can't we just, you know, both of us write what we got the other process to get, then read, and presumably after that, we'd, in a more complete example, we'd have like code to process what we just got. Yeah.
If the buffer isn't big enough, then you can't write everything.
So yeah, if the pipe doesn't have a big enough buffer, you can't write everything. So what's going to happen instead?
So just sit there and wait for the buffer.
Yeah. Oh, so yeah. So our policy for pipes, we learned if write can't find enough space in the buffer, it just waits. And the child here, so it's going to call write. It's going to wait for that buffer to be emptied. How is that buffer going to be emptied? By the parent reading from it. But we're going to ask the question, well, why isn't the parent reading from it? The parent isn't reading from it because it's writing to a different pipe that the child needs to read from. So we have this circular dependency. Both processes are waiting for each other to do something they're going to do in the future, but they'll never get there. And therefore, no one will ever make progress. So child's writing to the pipe, waiting for free buffer space, which won't be available to the parent reads, but the parent's waiting before it reads with the other pipe. And we can represent this visually with a graph in the sort of 2150 sense of vertices and edges. So we have here our parent process is waiting for space to write, and I'm going to represent waiting for as an arrow from a thread, which I'll represent with these circular nodes, to a resource, which I'll represent with a square node, and I'll represent a resource being somehow owned, or like at least cleaned up by, a thread with an arrow from the resource to the thread. So here our parent process is waiting for space to write in this pipe buffer from the parent to the child, which the child's going to free later, but the child's waiting for space to write the other pipe buffer, which the parent's going to free later. And when we draw things out this way, we can find our deadlock more easily because we can see that there's this circular dependency, and that's our problem, that everyone's going to be waiting for each other, so there's no one who's going to go first and solve the problem of freeing up space in these buffers. You know, someone would need to take action, but because of this loop, there's no one who's going to take action. If we omitted any one of these constraints, we wouldn't have the problem. So questions about this figure? Okay. So this is deadlock with pipes. So I started with that for a couple reasons. So one is that we covered it earlier, and you may have seen a version of this in the shell assignment. Like if you weren't passing the large amount of data through pipe test, you had a deadlock like this going on. And also to emphasize that although the most common situations for deadlock that people come across and that we'll talk about deal with locks, like mutexes, that's not the only situation in which we can have deadlocks. All sorts of resources are going to be vulnerable to deadlocks as long as we have this sort of waiting. Now, here, showing it with our pipes, let's go to the more classic situation for deadlock in programs, which is with locks. And you might say, like, a lot of our examples look pretty contrived. How can this happen in a program which isn't doing something silly, like arguably this is doing? So here I have a hypothetical OS where I represent directories by this structure with a lock, because we want to have lots of directories. We want to allow multiple threads to access different directories without taking turns. But for a single directory, we represent it by this map, presumably like a balanced tree. And we want to make sure that that's consistent. We don't have dangling pointers because some other thread's changing it while we're trying to access it. And I have this move file function, which takes two directories and a file name and just moves the file from one of those directories to the other by copying its directory entry and erasing the original one. And while it does this, it locks both directories, which it needs to do because otherwise someone reading the list of entries would get might find a dangling pointer because we're updating the tree that influenced the map. And a problem which can cause a deadlock is this scenario of two calls which are logically independent. So moving from A to B, the file foo, and moving from B to A, the file bar. And there should be no reason why we can't do both of these, and it's well-defined, like what should happen when we run both of these. But with the code I have here, when we run both of these, we could have a deadlock. And this sort of deadlock is especially pernicious. So our deadlock here, if the buffer, if huge size is big enough, this always deadlocks. The deadlock here, you're going to get lucky sometimes. So sometimes the two threads are going to call moveFile at slightly different times, and there's not going to be any problem whatsoever. The locks are just never going to be overlapping at all. And sometimes you'll call them at overlapping times, but you know, the second thread, when it's trying to get the lock, it will like be while it's moving, but late enough that it's not an issue. And it just waits for both of the locks before it goes. So where we're going to have our problem is when thread 2 sneaks in right here between those two locks. So thread A locks A, thread 1 locks A, thread 2 locks B. Then thread 1's going to try to lock B, while thread 2 tries to lock A. And none of them are going to be able to get the lock. And because the lock just waits for it to be unlocked, they're never going to stop. They're just going to wait there forever. So the move is never going to happen, and the unlocks are never going to happen. So questions about this deadlock scenario? So isn't there undefined behavior when you call lock twice? There's undefined behavior if you call lock twice on the same lock from the same thread. But we're not doing that because we're using separate locks or separate threads, or both. Okay, other questions? Okay, so we have this circular waiting, and I showed you sort of a graphical picture. We can draw that for this case. Thread 1's waiting for a lock on directory B, which is held by, and therefore needs to be released by, thread 2. And while thread 2 is waiting for a lock on directory A, which is held by, and therefore needs to be released by, thread 1. So there's our loop. Now, I'm going to this graph representation here because this is going to point out that we can't do some simple solution. So one thing you might say is, well, just detect if we have people doing move A, B, and B, A at the same time. Like, look for that pattern, and that might solve our problem. But this can happen with more complicated scenarios. So let's say we have three directories. We could have thread A, which is thread 1, rather, which is running a move from something from directory A to C, while 2 is doing a move from C to B, and 3 is doing a move from B to A. And now we have the same problem, even though we don't have two pairs, because our deadlock, like the dining philosopher's example, we have a larger round table than just two people. We have three, effectively, and we have the same problem. Questions? Scenario. So because we can have these more complicated, we're not just going to look for pairs of things, and this is something which could, accidentally happen. It would be annoying. So I showed you sort of deadlocks classically for locks. We can have them with other types of resources. And all the resources we've seen so far are kind of like you either have the, or like it's a single thing not like divisible in pieces, but you can also have it with resources like memory, where it's sort of about running out of capacity, not sort of there is a buffer, you have the buffer space or you don't. So for example, here, let's say I have an allocate or wait function. So rather, unlike malloc, if you don't have the space, it returns an error and probably you crash. But let's say we have a function which rather than returning an error, we just wait for enough memory to be free. We assume, you know, someone's like has 1,000 tabs open in their web browser. We'll just wait for that to be resolved and then we'll move on. So we have that function. And here are our two programs, both of them, you know, allocate 1 meg, then allocate another meg, then do some calculation, then free those 2 megs. And if we have a system with 2 megs of space, we should be able to run both of these programs. And in fact, we can. We can run thread 1, then thread 2, and things will work great. But we'll run into problems, even though we conceptually just have one resource, but you know, it's in different pieces, if both of these run at the same time in a particular way. So thread 1, we allocate 1 megabyte, thread 2 allocates 1 megabyte, and if we only have 2 meg, they'll both just wait forever for the other megabyte, and they're effectively waiting on each other. Now this is a case where I'm going to draw our dependency graph differently, and it's going to be less obvious from this sort of when we have this sort of split resource, and we'll talk about that probably at the end of today. Now, whether or not we have a deadlock. We have cycles, but you know, if we had 3 units of memory, it wouldn't be a problem. 3 meg of memory, we wouldn't have a deadlock here. And just because we have 2, that these cycles are a bad thing. And we have 2 cycles, you know, this cycle and this cycle. And, well, more than 2. We have this cycle and this cycle. There. We have a whole bunch of cycles in that graph, even though there's just 1 resource. But of course, we could have a normal case. So I've given lots of examples of deadlock, but we're going to want to be a little more precise about it. So I'm going to start talking about definitional things about deadlock. So deadlock, like intuitively, we mean the circular waiting for resources. And we'll be very generic about what resources means. It's lock, CPU time, disk space, memory, anything we can give to a thread. And in practice, it's often non-deterministic. Doesn't have to be non-deterministic, but that's why we're spending time talking about it, is because it's going to be really annoying to debug because it's something which is not reliable to trigger. And our most common example is acquiring locks, but because we have all these other types of resources, it's not the only example. And we could have deadlocks that involve like locks and something else at the same time. Now, deadlock might seem similar to something we've talked about earlier, which is starvation. But starvation and deadlock are different things. So in starvation, we have some thread or process or something which doesn't make any progress. And that seems like deadlock, right? Deadlock, things aren't making any progress. But the reason it's not making any progress is because someone else is getting lucky. Someone else is making a lot of progress. With deadlock, everyone who's involved in the deadlock situation doesn't make progress. So starvation is kind of a lose-win situation. There is a winner in starvation. With deadlock, there are no winners. Everyone's a loser. And this has some consequences. So starvation, we actually have a fix for. So like, if we know starvation is happening, at any point in time, we can say, gosh, we have starvation, let's stop having starvation and just take turns with whatever resource is being starved, and that will fix it. With deadlock, that's not going to really be an option because people are waiting for resources. You know, it's not just a case that they could have gotten the resources and didn't. So questions about deadlock versus starvation. Okay, so let's formally define deadlock. And my formal definition of deadlock is going to have these 4 components. So to have deadlock, we need to have mutual exclusion. We need to have some sort of resource which, when it's assigned to a thread, only one thread can use it. So this doesn't mean, you know, that precisely that class of resource isn't shared. So we can talk about memory meeting the mutual exclusion criteria, because when I give you a byte of memory, other threads don't have a byte of memory. But, you know, it has to be the case that we have mutual exclusion. So, like, if we talk about, like, the console, if all threads can always output, there's not mutual exclusion. You know, it's a shared resource. But we need non-shared resources. We need to have this hold and wait property. A thread needs to have a resource in the sense of preventing other threads from using it while it waits to acquire another resource. So we saw when I was talking about our deadlock with memory, I had this allocator wait function, which did precisely that. We had some stuff already allocated, and we were allocating more waiting. But our normal malloc function doesn't satisfy this property because it doesn't wait to acquire the other resource. And we'll see some other examples of not satisfying this property. We need to not have preemption of resources. So the biggest example of preemption we had was with the CPU. We don't have deadlock with something with our normal schedulers on our CPU because it's usually the case that whatever program is running, we can stop it and run something else. But we need resources where we can't, like, take them away. They are only released when the thread wants to do it. So we saw that with our pipe. You know, we can only get things out of the pipe buffer when the thread tries to read it. We can't just decide, oh, you wrote too much in the pipe, I'm going to get rid of it. And there was a good reason why, because, you know, that's not what, something we want pipes to do. We don't want pipes to discard data. And with locks, we can't just, like, say, oh, you have this lock for too long, I'm going to unlock it, because that would make our code, which is trying to have things behave correctly with locks, not behave correctly anymore. And we also need circular wait, meaning I can come up with a list of threads where the first thread's waiting on the second, waiting on the third, and so on, all the way up to some nth thread, which is waiting on the first. Now, I just say there exists one. It could be the case that there's multiple such lists, and that would be fine. So questions about any part of these definitions? So any of these four criteria? So I'm listing these. Yeah, sorry. Question, is there an exception to the first one? For what sort of case?
Like any scenario.
So the first one is requirement for deadlock. How it's satisfied in some cases might be a little subtle. So like with the memory out situation, the one resource that most one thread at a time can hold is any byte of memory, not all of memory. But it still satisfies that one thread at a time holds the resource, a unit of resource. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. So since we've reviewed the definition of deadlock, here's some code which has deadlock problems. So I have a doubly linked list. My list is A, B, C, D, E. I'm only going to deal with B, C, and D, so we don't have to worry about head and tail, null pointers, and all that. And to remove a node, I lock the node, lock the previous node, lock the next node, and update the previous and next node to make the node not be in the linked list anymore. And the question is, which of these calls could, if run for multiple threads in parallel, deadlock? Now, it's can deadlock, not will deadlock, because we know that it always depends on timing with locks. So we could get lucky and have everything work out. But which of these work? Could we get unlucky and have a deadlock? And you can discuss with your neighbor. I'll give you a couple minutes. Okay, who would like more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F, okay, G. Okay, so we're mostly E, some F. I think E is the correct answer. So I'll go over both why, so, and then why, and the question is like, why isn't A a problem? And those of you who thought A was a possible reason for a deadlock were probably thinking, oh, when remove node B and D happen, they have C in common, so that's going to cause our deadlock. But we'll talk about why that isn't. But first, when B and C happen at the same time, we lock B, we lock its previous thing, A, which is irrelevant. Then we lock C, try to lock C, and it's possible for C to happen at the same time and wait to lock B, and there's our deadlock. So we have one thread waiting to lock C on the thread which has C locked and is waiting to lock B while it has B locked. So that's our circular dependency. So as for B and D, if we think about what the dependency graph is going to look like, so here we have, you know, B, or I should say B is locked by the remove, is being waited for, or I should draw arrows consistent with what I did before. So remove C is waiting to lock B while remove B has it locked and is waiting to lock C, which remove C has locked. So wait for and has, wait, has. Now if we wanted to draw this same sort of circular picture for B and D, well, we have only C in common. So somehow remove B and remove D need to create a cycle, but all we can do is have one of them have the lock and one of them not. So it could be that, or it could be one of them has the lock and one of them's waiting for it in the other direction. Either way, that's not going to be enough for a cycle, and C is the only thing in common. So we can't get a cycle. Like, we can split the graph into two halves, which are connected by an edge going in one direction. There's no way to have a cycle, so deadlock's not possible. So questions about either part of this? Sort of why the B and C deadlock or the B and D not deadlocking? Okay. So now that we've looked at our definition of deadlock, let's talk about ways of preventing deadlock. And we're going to attack each of the criteria we had for deadlock. So one is attacking mutual exclusion. So if we have infinite resources, or enough resources that they never run out, so if we have infinite memory, then memory is not actually going to have that mutual exclusion property. We're never going to notice that, you know, threads can hold resources. If we have no shared resources, we won't have the problem. If we say when we start a thread, you get 2 megs of memory and that's all you have forever, well, then that allocator wait function's not gonna be a problem. You know, it's gonna allocate from that 2 meg or not do anything. Or wait forever, that's not a deadlock. We can avoid waiting. So we can have sort of a busy signal kind of thing. Or we can revoke or preempt resources. So we saw, you know already about sort of that don't wait approach. So we mentioned that malloc uses this approach, and that's by malloc can't deadlock. Malloc doesn't wait for resources. It's allocate or fail. So this was a deadlock if we waited. It's not a deadlock because we don't wait here. But the big question is, what do you do instead? And there are a couple options you might imagine. So we'll look at them in a bit. So let's think about one option is abort or retry. So we could imagine, what if we just abort and retry? You know, how would that work out? And I'm showing you this for memory, but we could do this with locks. So locks have an option for doing the thing where we fail instead, known as, and pthreads has a pthread mutex try lock. So there is a lock or fail in pthreads. So let's use that to implement the first strategy I mentioned here, which is trying again. And we'll talk about a different strategy, which is going to be to alternately try to revoke the lock to steal away the memory. We'll talk about that later. So if we're trying again, there's a big question of like how many times do we do that? So for example, here's our move file function where I'm going to keep retrying. So I have a loop, I get the first lock, I try to lock the second lock. If that works, I break, otherwise I keep going. Otherwise I unlock and try again. I unlock so there's a chance for another thread to sneak, you know, which I was conflicting with to get that lock. And this avoids deadlock, but there's no actual limit on how many times that loop runs. So we could have two threads that previously triggered a deadlock, and oh, I messed up this. This should be try lock here, and that should not be it. Where we have the same sort of situation where they lock, try to get the other lock, it fails, unlock, try again, and they just keep doing that indefinitely, potentially forever. Now, this isn't deadlock because the threads aren't actually waiting. So there's another name for this scenario, which is live lock, where we just keep aborting and retrying forever. So it's like deadlock in that no one's making progress, but it's unlike deadlock in that the threads aren't waiting. And it's arguably worse than deadlock. So with deadlock, you're like, why is my program not using any CPU? And you like go into the debugger and you figure out, it's waiting on these locks, and that might help you debug it. Live lock, you're like, my program's working really hard, must be really slow. You know, using lots of CPU, you go into the debugger, it's moving files, that's normal, okay. And then the question is, why isn't it actually making progress? So it's arguably worse. And this is a reason why generally we, because of problems like this, or even, and the inefficiency in general, we generally won't like this abort or retry solution, though it is valid. Now, I told you about this live lock problem. How could we prevent that? What could we do to, deal with live lock and make it, at least less bad? So we have this keep abort, retry, retry, retry scenario. How can we make that not so bad? So set a limit on how many times you can retry. So what do we do after that limit? So one option would be giving up, in which case, so that's a valid option that will solve that problem. It will make it more visible, so maybe that's better. But in the case of our move file, now move file sometimes fails randomly, which isn't great. So is there something else we could do? Yeah. So we could randomize our wait. So one observation is that this thing happening over and over again would just be because it's very predictable how long things take, and it just works out that it kept happening again and again and again. And if we randomize the timing, with high probability, it won't happen one of the times, that things won't be synchronized correctly. That's a valid solution. How about another solution? Yeah?
Could you try to steal the resource?
So if we had a way of revoking the lock, we'll talk about that in a sec, that would be an alternate solution. Yes, now there's some trickiness with that. How about another? Option. Any others? Okay, so another option, which is not actually that complicated, which is why I was expecting someone to come up with it, is that we could just say, well, you've been retrying a lot. Let's just pause all the other threads and just run you. You know, run threads one at a time and to fix the problem, you know, for a while until we get a resolution. Yeah. Question? You know, just go through threads one at a time rather than hiding them concurrently. So that's another possible solution to this problem. So you can deal with live lock, but most of the time we aren't very happy about it. So we're going to have another solution we'll talk about in a bit. Another thing we could do is revoke or preempt resources. So with memory, we could imagine an allocate or steal function where, you know, when you want to get an extra megabyte, we just take it from that other program. You know, if there's not enough memory, we'll just kill that other program to free a megabyte. Problem solved. No deadlock. But killing the other program maybe isn't so great. And if we're talking about this with locks, the problem is what's happening during that lock. Like, if we're in the middle of modifying a balanced tree, what's the state of the trees? Are all the nodes there? We want some way of undoing what's going on. And that sounds kind of crazy, but sometimes this is actually done. So databases actually commonly use this sort of strategy where they carefully set things up so they have code to undo a partial operation to make this work. And sort of what you might imagine it looks like is that you acquire a lock, and when you want to revoke the lock, you throw an exception in the thread that has the lock, and it undoes the operation and then releases it after it's done undoing. And that lets you take it away, even if it was waiting on some other resource. So questions about this idea? Okay. Now, our primary way, however, of dealing with deadlocks with locks is going to be this approach, which is avoiding circular wait. So the reason we had deadlock is because we acquired a lock and then acquired another lock that was acquired earlier. And we can avoid this if we acquire locks in a consistent order. And this is because if we think about our graph, all our edges are going to go in one direction when we do this. We're not going to have a path. So if we acquire A then B always, we're not going to have a path from B to A. So we can't have a cycle. So if we choose a consistent order, this avoids the circular wait property. And this is by far the most popular way and the most practical way of avoiding deadlock with locks. So what this might look like, let's say our move file example, we'll just decide what order we lock based on something. So here, I'm comparing the paths to the directories, but I could choose any order, like even pointer values. It just matters that every thread uses the same order. So, you know, if we decide to always acquire A, then B, every thread does that. You know, and if I have A, B, and C, they always acquire A before B, A before C. You know, as long as we're consistent, we won't have a cycle because we'll always go A to B, A to C, B to C, and so on. We won't have those backwards edges in the graph. Therefore, we can't have a deadlock. We just choose any ordering whatsoever. And this is something that you'll see in real big software projects. So for example, in the Linux kernel, they have multiple locks of various sorts, and they enforce this ordering by having the programmers do it. So there are comments in the Linux kernel saying, hey, there's a bunch of locks in this code, and if you need to use them, you should acquire this LDT user semaphore lock before you acquire mmap semaphore, before you acquire context lock. So if you're writing a function that needs the LDT lock semaphore and the context lock, you get the LDT semaphore first, always. And They have similar rules elsewhere, and this is a very common way of doing this in practice, is that you just like tell the programmers, this is the order you must acquire locks in, and they're responsible for making sure the code obeys those orderings. Okay. So questions? This consistent order. So as I said, like not spending that much time, but this is what you should do almost all the time with locks to avoid deadlock. It's just choose an ordering and make sure everyone does it. Okay, another way we can avoid it is we can get all our resources at once. So with move files, that function, the problem that caused the deadlock is that we had to separately get the first directories and the second directories locked. If we had a way of simultaneously getting both of them, there would be no problem. So in general, if we had a way of getting all the resources at once, we wouldn't be holding a resource while waiting for another. So if we had a way of implementing that, or you made a way of implementing that, and one thing you might imagine doing this is you might say, when I start a thread, I check all the resources it needs, and I don't start the thread unless those are all available. And some embedded systems might even actually do this. This is something you could really do in those sort of constrained scenarios where you know I have a thread to like manage, this, button or something like that, and you know exactly what you need. So, talked about preventing deadlocks. So questions about preventing deadlocks? Yeah?
How do you know if you acquired the one before?
How do I know if I... So the question is, how do I know if my code does that? You have to look at, if I'm acquiring lock B, what could I have acquired before based on how your code is structured? And if it's hard to figure out from your code, well, that's a problem. And that happening is why people commonly write software which has deadlocks, is because it's usually often like their code is complicated, so they can't figure that out all the time. Okay. So we talked about deadlock prevention. I'm going to also talk about deadlock detection. So there's like two reasons for this. So one reason you might do this is for debugging. Another reason is that if in cases where you can't avoid deadlock, a strategy for dealing with it is to like do things like revoke locks after figuring out there's a deadlock, in which case you need to detect there's a deadlock. So let's look at a simple deadlock detection case. Let's say I'm writing a threading library, and I want to have a debugging feature which says, which finds all your deadlocks. So like you're in the debugger, and you can run some function saying, I think my program's deadlocked, tell me how. So what information should I add to my threading library to implement this? I have a structure to represent each thread, a structure to represent each lock, each mutex. I only care about deadlocks involving just mutexes, which is a big limitation, but we'll deal with that. So just mutexes, what information should I be tracking? But something that would be useful to have. So this is like, program's deadlock. I just want to tell the user, hey, yes, you have a deadlock. Here's what it is. And then just for deadlocks with mutexes, we're not going to worry about anything else. So what would be useful to know for that? Like any piece of information. Yeah?
How many mutexes the thread is using?
So what mutexes the thread is using? So what do you mean by using?
I guess you're kind of be split up, so you'd have one, it's like ones that it owns versus ones that it like needs or will use somewhere else.
Using, so owns, so has locked, and ones that it is waiting for. And I believe this is sufficient, assuming you have a list of all threads. So what do you do with this information? So remember those graphs I drew, you can draw that graph. So you can say, I can take every mutex, I can draw the owns lines to a thread, and I can draw the waiting for lines with the thread. And from that, I can draw the whole graph with all the threads, and then I use algorithms you may or may not have forgotten from 2150 to figure out if there's a cycle in the graph. So topological sort or depth-first search, after you make this graph, you can find a cycle in it. If there's a cycle, there's a deadlock. And if not, well, if there's a deadlock, it doesn't involve just mutexes. Some questions about this procedure. So that's deadlock detection. So one little note about deadlock detection. So I showed you here, this is how you do deadlock detection with non-divisible resources. Like the mutex, either the thread has all the mutex or none of it for each mutex. With things like memory, which is divisible, it gets a lot trickier. So to give it a motivation why, let's say I have 6 meg of RAM, and we're doing that allocate or wait thing. And we have 2 threads waiting for 2 meg, and there's only 1 meg 3, and that's because there's a third thread which is waiting for a key press. So it looks like we're deadlocked, but we're not really deadlocked. Because eventually thread 3 is going to get its key press, it's going to finish what it's doing, and then thread 1 or 2 will get its 2 megabytes, it will finish, the other thread will get its 2 megabytes and finish, and everything's going to be fine. But we can make some small changes to this scenario, and it would be a deadlock with involving the memory. Like if we had 5 megs of RAM, would be a deadlock. Thread 1 or 2 would never finish, and thread 3 is just irrelevant. If thread 3 is waiting for a lock held by thread 1, that will create a cycle that matters, and it would be a deadlock. And so to figure this out, we're going to need a real deadlock detection needs a more complicated algorithm that we're not actually going to cover, but I want you to know exists, that takes into account these divisible resources. So we can distinguish that this scenario is not a deadlock because thread 3 is going to finish and then things are okay. But this scenario is a deadlock, and this scenario where we just decrease the amount of memory is a deadlock. So we're not going to tell you what that algorithm is. You can look it up. But I want you to know there's a way of doing it if you need to do it. Okay, that's all I have for today.